Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, we're going to talk about how we live out our faith every day, and it's oftentimes in the everyday aspects of life that we see faith really take root, take hold, and grow. I'm Neil Stavem. Great to have you along. Thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith. Ted Ross at the controls, and Chris is the phone. And Ted, both you and I had the opportunity to grow up in a family where parents were committed to the faith, and having a godly mother goes a long way.
It really does, yeah. Even if there's a period of wandering away from the faith, those seeds that were planted from a young age take root later in life.
So we'll talk about moms today, particularly. It's a little course that maybe you've heard. We're building every day at our work and at our play, not with hammer, blow on blow, not the timber sawing so. Building a house not made with hands, following Father's perfect plans. Little builders, all are we, building for eternity. And it's kind of a kid's song, but it's one that our guest today heard plenty of times growing up. And I resonated with the story as well as we get into it. Len Sweet has been on my list of people to talk to for some time. And he writes regularly and has written prolifically and got great content. And so we've been meaning to connect with him, and his new book just came out, and it's the perfect opportunity to welcome him back to Connecting Faith as we talk how our heritage shapes our story. And the book is called Mother Tongue. And let me introduce Leonard Sweet, who holds the E. Stanley Jones Chair at Drew University. He's founder and president of Spirit Ventures Ministries, also served as a distinguished visiting professor at George Fox University, and one of the leading figures in the emerging church movement and a major figure in discussions about Christianity's transition to post-modernity. And a popular speaker, written a number of books, including Jesus Drives Me Crazy, Soul Tsunami, Salsa, one that he and his friend Frank Viola just wrote not too long ago, Jesus Speaks, Learning to Recognize and Respond to the Lord's Voice. And with that, let's jump in and have a conversation about Mom. Len, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Good to be with you, Neil. Thank you for having me.
You know, I was just mentioning you've written a number of books, and I know several of them recently have been focused on helping us understand how Jesus speaks to us or how we can find him throughout all the scriptures, Old Testament and New. And now this latest one talks about, I guess, as I was reading it, that, well, it's just one of the other ways that God communicates to us, and that's through our mothers, so probably shouldn't surprise us. But as you started putting this book together, I'm sure you probably realized that's just another way that God really helps us understand who he is.
Yeah, well, the book was really written, too, to try and remind the church and the Christian parents specifically that we've for too long outsourced faith development to the church, and it's time to bring it back into the home. And my book came out about the same time as the Benedict Option did, Rod Dreher has done. So it's kind of a case study of what the Benedict Option has looked like in the past. I hope we wouldn't do it the same way my mother did it, but it's a real case study of what that Benedict Option was in the life of this one family who lived on Hungry Hill, and my mother raised three kids. Neither of my parents had a college degree, and yet none of us got any money at all to go to college, and yet we all had PhDs. So it's quite a tribute to mother what she accomplished on this little postage stamp of a lot on this place called Hungry Hill. And it was a hard book to write, but a fun book to write.
Well, and as you say, you just kind of took different aspects of life at home and, memories, and really kind of touched on all the senses, maybe just sort of tastes and smells and sounds and all those things. But maybe introduce us a little bit to your mother, because she maybe wasn't the typical mom of three boys in terms of her faith journey.
Yeah, it was a late marriage. My mother didn't, and my father was a little younger than mother, but mother didn't get married until she was in her mid-30s, didn't have start having us till she was in her late 30s and early 40s. She had a ministry ahead of that. She went to God's Bible School, which is a Bible school that she didn't graduate from high school. She just went right to the school and learned Bible and then became a home missionary and then got ordained in the Pilgrim Holiness Church and was an evangelist and church planter and young people's worker and a musician. And so she kind of filled a lot of cracks in the church for many years and had quite a ministry. We buried my mother from the church that she founded and was its first pastor in a little Pilgrim Holiness. Now it's Wesleyan Church in Covington, Virginia. So she was an early woman evangelist, preacher, Bible teacher, church planner.
That was fairly rare at the time, wasn't it?
It was very the holiness tradition always had a place for women in ministry, but it was more in theory than in practice. And so Mother's one of the few that actually did the practice, although she got in a lot of trouble, as I tell in the book, so that's part of the fun part of the story.
Well, and of course, there's enough trouble that you got into, and we'll maybe get into some of that if we have time. But we'll save that for the end to kind of build to that.
Yeah, right? So I hope we won't get to that. No,
I think a lot of listeners resonate with some of the anecdotes and the habits that your mom had, daily responsibilities raising her family, because she really took it on as when she, when you guys came along, she in. Through, I guess, various circumstances, kind of pull back from her, church planting and evangelism outreach. And so then she's taken on a new charge, and that's raising up little boys to be godly men.
Yeah, and she had a mantra. I think I mentioned this in the book. If I didn't, I should have. Her mantra was, she called us boys. She said, boys, I'm not going to isolate you, but I am going to insulate you. Hmm. So she meant that she wasn't going to isolate us from the world. We were to be in the world. She had this real good sense of in the world, but not of it. So she's not going to isolate us from the world, but she is going to insulate us. And the place where she believed you got insulated was in the home. And she didn't outsource faith development to the church. She took personal responsibility for insulating us in the Christian faith. And so we got a high R factor insulation. We had family prayer twice a day, first thing in the morning, last thing at night. We had Bible study, always in Bible study, reading, Bible memorization. At age 5, we started to memorize 12 verses a week and 12 weeks on, 12 weeks off. And so we were heavily padded with that insulation, and we kind of became mother's little mini church, where the Bible says we're two or three, and we were five, and the five of us, my mother, my father, and my brothers, were 1 year apart. I'm the oldest, and so we were her little congregation, and she sent us to the public school, but she homeschooled us in the faith, in Christianity.
Well, we do have to maybe just talk a little bit, example of is finding a church home, because that changed a little bit, because there was a time when a television came into the sweet home, and that created a little bit of stir at the church.
Yeah, that's when we were Free Methodist. My father was Free Methodist. My mother was Pilgrim Holiness. I call Pilgrim Holiness the Marine Corps of Methodism. I mean, they were. It was close to Amish as you can get. The women showed no skin and didn't bob your hair, and that's where mother got in a little trouble. She bobbed her hair at a wedding, and you couldn't wear any jewelry. When you got engaged, you got a watch. And my father was a Free Methodist, and he gave my mother a ring, and so she got in trouble with the Pilgrims. So, and we became Free Methodists, and Frees, you couldn't have television was the devil's blinking box. That's what it was called, the devil's blinking box. So I grew up watching the radio. We'd sit around the radio, and my father would choose the things he wanted to listen to, and we'd all have to there was one program in particular, Let the Lower Lights Be Burning. It was from Boston, a rescue mission, and he loved that show. And anyway, at age nine, my father finally said, I want to watch Bonanza. It was Bonanza that brought the whole thing crashing down. And I tell a little bit about the impact of Bonanza on Sunday Night Worship, because the church thought it could take on culture and win. You can't take on Disney and Bonanza and win. And all I had to do was back up Sunday Night Worship, just 1 hour, just back it up a little bit. But no. The church said, no, we're going to take on pop culture. And so my father finally allowed a TV into the home. I didn't know what the big fuss was about because we got to watch 2 hours a week, 1 hour on the weekend, which was usually, you know, something my father wanted, and the other was 1 hour during the week. So this whole furor over this television was a mystery to me. But so we got kicked out of the Free Methodist Church. My mother had then gotten ordained in the Free Methodist, and so her ordination was removed, and she was defrocked, and the church exercised a ban on us. So that's how I became Methodist. Methodists will take anybody, and they were glad to get this sweet family. So my father tithed, and so the people love that. So, okay. So that's how I'm sure. A Methodist to this day, that sure. Thanks to that church taking us in. But, that TV got in us a lot of trouble.
You're getting, culture's changed a little bit then. Len Sweet has been watching culture for a number of years and writing about it, writing effectively. He's the E. Stanley Jones Professor of Evangelism at Drew Theological Seminary. And author of a number of books, I think probably 60. And this is one of his latest. It's a great read. It's called Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. And Len just takes some of the little things that happen in the home and just draws out some great insights from that. And we will we'll talk a little bit more about Mother Tongue coming up in a moment. We do have some copies to give away. If you grew up in a home where a mom was going to train up her kids to be the congregation that they needed, you'll appreciate this book, and you can sign up for a free copy of that. We'll do a drawing at the top of the hour. Call us at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH, and give us your contact information. We'll do the drawing for that, three or four books. We've got that at the top of the hour. More with Len Sweet coming up. Great old gospel song, one that Len Sweet grew up hearing time and time again. We're talking with Leonard Sweet today. Len is one of the world's most influential evangelicals, as a sharp cultural critic who helps us see how to get in front of the future rather than be bowled over by it. And one of his greatest influences was his mother, and he's written about it in a great new book called Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. And Len, talk about the upright piano in the home and the music that was a regular part of your discipleship.
Yeah, and I talk about the importance of a soundtrack. Faith needs a soundtrack, and this culture needs a soundtrack. I mean, this culture, the language is story built around an image, but it has to have a soundtrack. If you look on YouTube and see some of these, you got some songs out there that have 2 billion hits. We got 7 billion people in the world, and 2 billion of them have bothered to go to YouTube and listen and like a song. It's just amazing the power of a soundtrack. And the Bible does say faith comes by hearing, and the importance of the ear gate. And the soundtrack for me was after family prayer of an evening. Mother didn't do this before we went to school, but of an evening, last thing we did before bed is have a family prayer time. And we always prayed on our knees. That's what the holiness people did. You prayed on your knees. You got up. We hugged Mother and Dad, and then we went upstairs. She dismissed us to go upstairs to bed, and then she would go to the upright piano, and we would call down for as long as we could stay awake songs, hymns that we wanted her to play, our favorite hymns. And so she would tuck us in musically every night. We grew up with a soundtrack to faith. And when I deconverted, as I tell the story in the book, at 17, I deconverted from Christianity, but for about 6 years, I was just an atheist. I became a Marxist, at one point even a Maoist. But what kept me tracking was that soundtrack. I could not escape that soundtrack. And that soundtrack helped bring me back and bring me back stronger than when I left. So I can't say enough about the need for a soundtrack. And it was a soundtrack that I learned in the home. And it was a soundtrack that we shared as a family unit. It wasn't just everybody had their own soundtrack. We shared a family soundtrack.
You know, even though your mother and father weren't college educated, I mean, they were going to make sure that you had education. I mean, you all took your turns at the piano, right, and other instruments as well. So, I mean, that was
we did. Yeah, music was not an option. We had we got to choose. We all had to learn the piano. But we got to choose what else on top of the piano we wanted to play. And my middle brother chose a guitar. My youngest brother chose the clarinet. I chose a baritone, but my band director chose a bassoon for me because he needed a bassoonist. So I didn't really get to choose. I got chosen for me. I hated the bassoon, but I didn't want to disappoint my band director. So. But yeah, we had the music part was huge, and this is really amazing to me. I didn't mention this in the book, but we have an image of Jesus preaching. If I say to your listeners right now, give me an image of Jesus healing, they can do it. Give me an image of Jesus eating, they can do it. Give me an image of Jesus preaching, they can do it. Give me an image of Jesus singing, they can't do it. But we know he sang. He had there's a hymn book in the middle of the Bible. It's called the Psalms. You never, a good Jew, never said the Psalms. The Psalms were meant to be chanted. And we know Jesus sang a hymn. It says there in the Bible that before they went out, he went out to the garden, the Olive Garden. He and his disciples in the upper room sang a hymn. We also know the last thing he did, he ushered himself into eternity singing a hymn. Psalm 22, the greatest song ever sung in the history of the world. Jesus sang from the cross. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And the psalm ends, it is finished. We understand that Jesus is singing. In that psalm, there's I thirst. I mean, those things that we call the last words of Jesus were really part of this song. At least three or four of them were that he sang on the cross. So the soundtrack is so huge and important.
I'll let you catch your phone.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's all right.
Turned it off.
Yeah. It's your brother calling to see if you still have a favorite song. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And one of the ways to, I mean, one of the great things about this, story that you've collected is that your mother took every opportunity to really shape your life and your story. In fact, those, the insulation, as you will, of the faith, inculcating it that, but it scripture comes through through hymns as well, and just in fact, I know she also helped you celebrate the God in nature, right? I mean, she was a mountain girl, so she appreciated the rocks and trees
but all those rocks she related to biblical images and stories. Hmm. Every rock had a. She always brought it back to the scripture, to the story. I mean, Jews don't put flowers on their grave; they put a rock. And so, I learned all this stuff growing up because Mother was always associating nature You know, when we got the cedar, we looked at a cedar tree. We knew those were the cedars of Lebanon. That's where they came from. They started there, you know. And so part of how I learned the whole story, and a heavily verse, I mean, it was all about Bible verses. And so I got an acute case of versitis because the whole Bible was sliced and diced into these verses. But what enabled me to see it as one story and to kind of reconnect with it after my deconversion as one story, I say from Genesis to the maps, it's one story. And what enabled me to do that was Mother's constant everything in life she would bring back to that story. Well, that's here. You find that here. You find that here. You know, that's Gideon. Well, that's Elijah. That's so everything. Everything in our house. And the reason I tell the book, I tell the story in the book through material culture. They say evangelicals don't have material culture. That's Catholics have material culture in their faith, and evangelicals don't. We're all about the Bible and verses. And no, but we do. And we don't appreciate how we do. But, I mean, I grew up with Bible verses framed on the wall. I mean, we didn't have pictures. We didn't have holy pictures. We had holy verses. That's still art. That's still material culture. And so I try, and the book is organized. I tell stories through things, through artifacts. But I also, in my home, with my kids, everything in our house has to have a story. If it doesn't have a story, it's stuff, and we don't surround ourselves with stuff. So that's part of spring cleaning. You know, we get rid of it. So everything has to have a story. And so with the kids, it's passing on those stories. I mean, by everything, I mean chairs, lamps, everything has to have a story. And I try and find a way to tie all those stories to the biblical story, to the greatest story never told, because we don't know it as a story. We just know it as these sliced and diced up points and verses. It is the greatest story. And this is a culture where that's how they communicate, is in story form. And so we need to learn how to speak to this culture with our story.
We've just got a minute before the break. Well, maybe we'll hang on to it after the break because we won't have time to get into it, because we want to find out more about that. If there were times when, you know, your mother sort of developing the story and said, well, that doesn't, you know, that seems like a stretch. It's like, you know, okay, is that really, you know, what the Bible, is that really the Bible story? Well, we'll find out more about that. Also, we need to check in about an experience or two when Lennon's brothers would come home and Mom was gone and wondering, okay. wondering what had happened there.
Now you're scaring me. Yeah.
I know, well, sure, because there's some of us that you know, grew up in homes like that too, and say, you know, if the rapture's coming, are you ready? We'll find out. Find out if Len was ready. Len Sweet joining us today, author of some 60 books, and the latest is called Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. And we got some copies to give away. You can sign up for it today at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And we'll talk more about how our heritage affects and shapes our legacy. And we'll celebrate moms together here in just a moment on Connecting Faith. On our march to Zion, can look back at the godly heritage growing up in a home where mom and dad were diligent about sharing, living out their faith, sharing scriptures, teaching us, training us, discipling us, correcting and reproving, and all those things. And Len Sweet is sharing a bit about his growing up years, told in a new book called Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. Len is the E. Stanley Jones Chair at Drew University, a professor of evangelism there, and a visiting distinguished professor at George Fox University and Tabor College, and he's written a number of books and a great writer, and just having a conversation today about, you know, those experiences growing up in a family where mom was determined to train up her boys to be the godly men that they should be. You know, you were talking, Len, about, you know, that we find, you know, find God in the rocks and everything else. I mean, were there times where you said, well, oh, that you're making that story stretch too far?
Yeah, I did, and you know, I just pushed mother all the time. I was the doubter. My brothers were much more pliable and acquiescent. I was the one who fought her and struggled with all this. Tried to put everything through an intellectual grid, you know, and mother and I had a lot of fun arguments, and they weren't so fun at times. So, but yeah, as I look back on it today, though, this is part. Mother really didn't understand this, but this is part of Jewish culture. Jewish culture is a religious requirement to ask questions, and from day one, you're taught as a Jew that the Torah is strong enough to take on anything you can bring it. So bring it on. And so that's why the Jewish table, these Jewish kids they're used to debating and arguing at table. If you look at Judaica, some of these paintings of Talmudic scholars around a table with the Torah open, they're all flailing their arms and arguing with one another. But the mother had the sense that bring it on, you know, there's nothing you can bring on that the story can't take on. So you don't think there was a whale big enough to swallow Jonah? Bring it on. Let's debate it and let's talk about it. And so that's how I grew up with this. Mother wasn't afraid of asking questions. There was kind of this Jewish sense, and she didn't, I don't think, related it to that tradition, but there was this bring it on. The story can take on anything. And we were strict inerrantists growing up. That, you know, mother was a strict inerrantist. Every single thing in the Bible was not just, you know, inspired and infallible. It was an inerrant. And so we had some massive arguments growing up. But she encouraged it. She didn't rebuke us for doing it.
Well, speaking of afraid, you do tell a story, and it made me chuckle, and we probably had some experiences like that. You come home after school one day, and mom's gone. No one seems to be around. And your first thought is, what if the raptures happen?
It wasn't just one day, though. I mean, this happened a bunch of days. It was the most terrifying moments of a young kid's life. I was the oldest, you know, so I felt responsibility for my brothers. We're all a year apart, but I was the oldest. And I knew they weren't going to be caught up. We were pre-tribulationists, you know, that you were going to be raptured before the tribulation. Of course, the tribulation is the release of the devil and Antichrist and all this stuff. And this was reality for us. And we were brought up expecting Jesus to return any minute and to be prepared. And if we were found in the wrong place, we may not go. So I come home it was almost, and I knew my brothers were going. So the fact they were there didn't mean anything. If mother, and then I try and call mother, but I couldn't get her. There was always my father, but my father didn't want you to call him at work. He was a low level. He was a teller, bank teller. And I wasn't sure. I knew he snuck out and went to movies, so I wasn't sure he was going either. I would panic. I'd break out into sweats. I mean, literally, it was just the most terrifying moment. And there was one person, and I've always been sensitive to hang-ups for this reason. I knew she was going, my mother's best friend. Her name was Ruth Kuhn. She died last year, by the way. And I knew she was going, so I call her, and if she answered the phone, I would hang up really quick. So I would get some relief. And, you know, to this day, if there's a hang-up, I don't get angry because I was responsible for many hang-ups growing up when I was a little kid.
No, that's worth reminding. And reality, we should be living as if Jesus could come back at any day, right? I mean, that would make a difference.
Absolutely.
If we live that way.
Absolutely, yeah. But also, you know, you begin, I live every day as if it could be my first or my last. The first day of the rest of my life or the last day of the rest of my life. And Jesus didn't even know when, he said, I was hidden with the Father. You know, it's the trick question. Is there anything Jesus didn't know? Well, of course, he knew everything. Well, wait a minute. One thing, he said, even I don't know the date of my return. So we got to be humble about it. But we ought to expect that hope every day.
Your family was known for their liniment, and didn't always use the medical profession. Maybe that had to do with as much with the poverty as anything else. But talk about that.
It did. It had to do a lot with the poverty. But it also, my father's side, Welsh and English, and the first Swedes came over in 1630. And they were these people that were kind of natural healers, bone setters, they were called. So there's a whole tradition of bone setting Swedes, and it connected me and my story to the healing story of the Bible. Jesus did three things. He spent his 3 years doing three things: preaching, teaching, and healing. There are 40 some healing stories in the Gospels. 40 some healing stories. And we all think of Jesus as a preacher. We think of him as a teacher, but we don't think of him enough as a healer. And what does it mean that part of the gospel, this is, I'm the one that healeth thee. And so that whole tradition of healing and health. In 1524, when William Tyndale translated for the first time the Bible from the Greek into English, Neil, he had to come up with this word that we translate as salvation. What did Jesus do on the cross for us and give us salvation? Now, salvation is a healing word, too. It comes from salve, oil. But his translation, he didn't use salvation. He used the word health, that the gospel brings us total mind, body, spirit, wholeness, wellness, salvation. Mind, body, spirit, all of our being integrated, which is a state of health. So we've got to recapture, I think, the healing function of the gospel and reconnect with Jesus, the healer. I've never had anybody come to seminary and say, everybody come to seminary, I want to come here to be a great preacher. Some say, I want to come here to be a great teacher. I've never had anybody come to seminary and say, I'm here to be a great healer. But that's what we're talking about. We need to learn what it means that that the gospel heals and that Jesus heals.
Len, your mother was very passionate and active in faith, Bible reading, church, prayer time, all those things. Your father may be a little less inclined. You're probably speaking to a lot of people who grew up in similar homes where one parent was much more active than another. How did you perceive that?
Well, it was – Dad was very very quiet, very shy, brilliant mind, but he was always in the background. I never kind of knew where he was spiritually. I knew he was following in Mother's way because he loved her so much, but I wasn't sure how much of it was him or how much of it was Mother. So, yeah, there was a strong mother with tremendous faith and love for Jesus, a father that was, and I knew he snuck out and went to movies. So that was made him a little suspect. And he did this behind Mother's back. So I was never sure about Dad's salvation.
So. Looking back, are there conversations you'd maybe wish had occurred and things you'd like to say if you're given the opportunity? I mean, as you said, you took a little 7-year journey in the land of the prodigal before coming back.
Yeah, this is, in some ways, it was the best thing that happened to me because I was so, the dominant environment of the home was so strong, Neil, that it was, there's anthropologists have this concept called liminality, a state of liminality. And the metaphor really is wetlands. What keeps a river, any kind of body of water, fresh and the water pure? Well, it's wetlands. So some of the water has to leave the river, and it has to create this swamp. But it's the swamp is the filter. It's the filtering system that removes the toxins and the poisons and the sediment from the river. And as long as the swamp keeps tracking, those wetlands keep tracking with the river, there will come a time when that water will return to the river, but it will return the purest, most pristine water, because it's all been, all the toxins have been removed in that wetlands. And that's why everybody's now protecting the wetlands, because it's nature's filtering system. And so for me, that deconversion was the wetlands. It was a swamp. I entered the swamp. I lived in that swamp for 7 years. Some people say I sold all the oats. No, I planted a prairie and lived in a swamp. But that was the time when a lot of the heavy legalisms and all that stuff that I had grown up with needed to be filtered out. And so I came back, when I came back at 23 into the faith, I came back so much stronger and so much more passionate. And because I had, but I, again, I kept tracking because of that soundtrack. That soundtrack kept me tracking with the river. And I don't know what I would have done without that soundtrack. I have another brother who's a Presbyterian minister. He went to Princeton, got his PhD at the Free University of Berlin. But he again, we talk about the power of that soundtrack to keep you tracking with the river. You just keep tracking it.
This book, Mother Tongue, will remind you of the soundtrack maybe of your life experience and your journey, and just to remind you again of those little everyday things from liniment to yellow cheese to any number of possibilities of things that we don't have time to get into. But Len Sweet's a great storyteller and a wonderful writer, and this is a wonderful tribute to his mother and some great spiritual lessons for us as well. Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story, written by Len Sweet, who is E. Stanley Jones Professor of Evangelism at Drew Theological School and visiting distinguished professor at George Fox University and author of more than 60 books. And Len, appreciate just sharing a few stories with us today. It was good to reconnect and look forward to chatting down the road again.
Yeah, this makes a great Mother's Day gift, by the way.
No question about it.
May 14th, yeah.
Yeah, it is coming up. Yeah, I'm glad that you know the day. So you're good for us. All right. Len, thanks so much for checking in today.
Thanks.
All right. By the way, we do have some copies to give away. You want a copy? Get in time for Mother's Day. You can sign up at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. More coming up in a moment. Remembering heritage a bit today. How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. That's the subtitle of Len Sweet's book called Mother Tongue. And, you know, it's all about growing in our faith, and it takes daily discipline. It takes, as Jeff Mannion puts it, holy redundancy, a persistence and determination to move faithfully in the right direction. And during our last segment here of today's Connecting Faith, I would just share a little bit from a conversation I had with Jeff Mannion not too long ago as we talked about his book, Dream Big, Think Small, Living an Extraordinary Life One Day at a Time.
2,500 years ago, when Aesop's fables were collected, one of Aesop's fables from Greece, from classical Greece, was the tortoise and the hare.
Yeah.
You know, that race between the rabbit and the turtle, and the rabbit takes off out of the starting blocks, and the tortoise just kind of moseys along and ends up winning the race when the rabbit stops to take a nap. In the moral of the story, each of those end with a little, you know, a punchline, and it's slow and steady wins the race. And it's not the slow part, you know, because any of us, you know, can mosey along at a snail's pace. It's the steady part. It's just moving forward. And it's not glamorous. It's not flashy, but faithfulness. What we're talking about here is faithfulness. Faithfulness is good. And most often when you look at the heart of any organization, whether it's a hospital, college, a school, or a church that has really been excellent over an extended period of time, look at its core and you will find a group of devoted people who just kept showing up. Faithfulness, it's a powerful thing.
So hence the book, Dream Big, Think Small, Living an Extraordinary Life One Day at a Time. And in the book, you suggest we maybe consider ant power. Say a little bit more about the premise of the book and ant power.
Yeah, and on the cover of the book, I have these little ants marching across the cover carrying the word small. And it was taken from Proverbs, King Solomon, Proverbs chapter 30, I think it's verse 25. Says, ants have little power, but they store up food during the summer. And it's just this little two-line proverb, this little couplet, where wise King Solomon says, listen, consider the ant. It just goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, carrying seeds into an anthill. And the goal is to set aside enough food so it doesn't starve, the colony doesn't starve during the winter. But they're small. The contrast there is between the smallness of the ant and yet the momentum that's built up over time, not because of the individual trips, but because of the sum of those trips. And therein lies the power, and there also lies the challenge of bringing ourselves again and again, often to mundane tasks.
Well, I think we understand the mundane task part, but how does that tie in with dreaming big?
You know,
we're just doing our kind of our daily job. We may not be dreaming big like we could be.
Well, by dreaming big, what I'm talking about there is building a healthy family, building a healthy spiritual life, taking the steps within our control to prepare for our future financially, to live a life of outrageous generosity, to care for our soul. That's the thinking big part. The dreaming big part, the thinking small part is just that daily activity you do to get there. So a person that has a big dream of being a spiritual giant, let's say, or just a great spiritual resource and mentor to others. Often what happens there, Neil, is it boils down to sitting with an open Bible for 20 minutes in the morning, day after day after day, reading a chapter of Scripture, taking notes on what you find, opening our heart to God, inviting God into our day, inviting God into our struggles. You know, 15, 20 years down the road, this person is a person that is sought for their wisdom, their discernment, and their advice, and their understanding of Scripture. But you break down what they actually did, and it probably wasn't the result of a three-day retreat or a mountaintop experience, but just this slow and steady discipline over time. And this is so powerful because it means that it's available to all of us. You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar. You don't have to be a business mogul. You don't have to be an all-American athlete in order to embrace slow, steady, consistent discipline. It just takes a long time to pull off to actually see the results we want to see.
I was thinking as I was reading the book about legacy. There's a lot of talk about legacy these days. Maybe there always has been, but yeah. You know, I don't know if we really always understand and honor what really goes into creating a meaningful, a positive, a significant legacy.
Yeah, and talking about legacy, it's just who do we desire to be remembered as, and what do we desire to be remembered for? And I don't know about you, Neil. There are different ambitions that fly through my heart at different times, and some of those are from God, and some of those are definitely not from God. You know, the desire to be known, the desire to be popular, the desire to make a big splash or something like that. There are other times, though, when I'm thinking clearly, and it's just I desire to be known as someone who's consistent. I desire to be remembered as someone who loved well and served well. I desire to be remembered for my humility. And so when you begin to look at those, suddenly you're into the quiet virtues, the legacy questions that don't make a lot of noise, don't make a huge splash, and are, again, that result of just bringing ourselves to people and bringing ourselves to the Lord again and again and again over a considerable period of time. I think that's how most legacies are born. And I think, unfortunately, many people who desire to live extraordinary lives start looking for something extraordinary to do. And I think that can be a huge mistake because most often, Neil, individuals who end up living greatly don't live greatly because they found something great to do. They live greatly because they found something good to do but they just repeated it over and over and over and over and over again. It really is living an extraordinary life, but it's lived one day at a time, not through these brilliant breakthroughs.
Getting some great insights today from Jeff Mannion, pastor at Ada Bible Church in Grand Rapids, been pastoring there for over 30 years, and author of The Land Between and Satisfied. This is a new book, Dream Big, Think Small, is an encouraging work that will take you. You can read it just a little chapter at a time and make it kind of a six-week devotional, and it will help you in your day-by-day journey to live a life of faithfulness. So, Jeff, I'm wondering, have we been maybe guilty of reading the Bible, looking for hero stories, maybe missing some important lessons?
I think there's this tendency, Neil, to skip the boring parts of the Bible. And the pictures that covered my Sunday school papers as a child, it was like David and Goliath, Daniel in the lion's den, Elijah calling down fire from heaven. And so often we skip over the parts where nothing much is happening. It seems like the biblical characters simply jump from one miraculous moment to the next, and they don't. I mean, in the David and Goliath story, this huge pivotal moment in young David's life, you know what he's doing before the David and Goliath incident, don't you?
Yeah. He's out in the backside of the mountain someplace taking care of sheep.
Now, his brother, when he shows up to the battle where Goliath is, facing off against the Israelites, his brother said, in whose hands have you left those few sheep? And so here's David, the future King David, and he's obediently, faithfully guarding the family flock of sheep, mundane, normal, non-extraordinary, just very ordinary work. And out of that came this extraordinary moment with Goliath. And I would just, I just encourage readers of the Bible, pay attention to the moments where not a lot of is happening. A lot of times those that paved the way for the extraordinary moments. That is, often God brings the extraordinary moments out of the ordinary moments.
You mentioned Daniel, of course. We, think about the lion's den, but there was that, passage where he talked about he went back to pray just as he had always done.
The Daniel the lion's den story, he's an aged man. This is at the end of his life and ministry. And every day he opens the windows of his house facing the city of Jerusalem. Now, he's a captive in Babylon, and he is facing the city of Jerusalem, I believe praying for its restoration because the city had been destroyed. And he does this day after day after day after day. The Daniel and the lion's den story happens as this pinnacle moment of a lifetime of prayerful faithfulness. And we do the Bible injustice, I believe, if we just focus on the climactic Daniel thrown into the lion's den, not eaten by the lions, and we miss those days of ordinary faithfulness.
Ordinary faithfulness, kind of what our focus has been on today. As we started out talking about Len Sweet's mother, she didn't look for burning bushes. She was one. Mabel Boggs Sweet, remarkable woman of faith, whose words, artifacts, and stories have outlived her. And Len Sweet put it together well in a great little book called Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. And that's, our heritage does affect our legacy. And that's why we need to look at ways that we can be faithful. Time in and time out. Persistent determination to move faithfully in the right direction. So I hope you've enjoyed the conversation today. If you want to hear the full conversation, Jeff Mannion, that's available on our show page and the website, as well as we'll post Len Sweet's conversation on Mother Tongue. We'll get that up here after the show. You can find it all at the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. So we can go home and, plan ways to make our kids more miserable as they grow.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Right.
We'll
the parental role. No.
That's right. Say, I do want to remind you, if you're a single mom, something for you coming up. Bridging the Gap is hosting a Dare to Dream single mom's retreat coming up in June. We've got information on our website, myfaithradio.com. So I want to just recommend that to you. If you know a single mom, it'd be a great opportunity for them to get loved on and get some encouragement. And don't forget about our Christian Writers Conference. We got information on that online as well at myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. And you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.